Scott Brown hopes for a rebirth in New Hampshire and a look back at one of the great governors in the history of Florida. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 19 of The Political Junkie. Scott Brown has all but made it official. He's formed an exploratory committee to run for the Senate in New Hampshire. It is official in Illinois. Democratic incumbent Pat Quinn and Republican challenger Bruce Rauner won their primaries on Tuesday and will face each other for governor in November. And we say goodbye to Reuben Askew, who brought Florida into the 20th century on race, tax reform, and ethics. But first, a trivia question based on what Scott Brown is trying to do in 2014. Who was the last Massachusetts statewide official who was defeated for re-election and then moved to New Hampshire to seek another statewide office? Send your answer to Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. Last week's question was, before Rand Paul, who was the last CPAC straw poll winner who never ran for president? The answer is George Allen. The Virginia senator won the 2006 straw poll and was considered a leading candidate for the 2008 GOP presidential nomination, but he never got that far. His macaca comment during a campaign event didn't help in his re-election bid.
So welcome. Let's give a welcome to macaca here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
He lost to Democrat Jim Webb. And the randomly selected winner is Wendy Bryant of Green Bay, Wisconsin. Wendy wins that button. And last week's scuttlebutton puzzle? The first button was Better Dead Than Red. The second button, Heritage Hotshots for Dick Thornburg. Then came Chile, see, Junta, no, support the Chilean people. And finally, there were two buttons for Florida's Claude Pepper. So when you add them up, you get, of course, Red Hot Chili Peppers. And so I'm going to take that great button and give it away now to Steve Sturdivant of Louisville, Kentucky. You can keep up with the latest scuttlebutton puzzles, trivia, and the refund I got for my singing lessons at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Suddenly, a new Senate race has become worth talking about. Scott Brown said he will explore a run in New Hampshire against Democratic incumbent Gene Shaheen. The last time we saw Scott Brown, he lost his bid to hold on to his Senate seat in Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren beat him pretty handily in 2012. Brown's first appearance on the political scene was when he shocked the nation by winning the Senate seat long held by Ted Kennedy. That was in January of 2010. Since his 2012 defeat, he sold his house in Massachusetts and has been showing up more and more in New Hampshire. Josh Rogers is a political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio and is here to talk about the suddenly interesting Senate race. Josh, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Good to be here, Ken.
All along, Gene Shaheen was seen as a solid favorite for a second term. Does Scott Brown's moves change the calculation?
Well, it certainly makes the race more competitive on paper. There's been a lot of polling done on this race, even though Scott Brown isn't officially a candidate. There have been several polls. Most show Gene Shaheen up comfortably about 8 to 10 points. She's a tough campaigner. She's been around New Hampshire politics for a long time. She served three terms as governor and was a state senator before that, and actually came up as a political operative working on Gary Hart's presidential campaign, for instance. And she's only lost one campaign that she ran, and that was in 2002 after serving three terms as governor against former Senator John E. Sununu. That was a big Republican year against a tough opponent. So she's still a formidable candidate, and Republicans still see her that way, but they certainly see Scott Brown as perhaps having the best chance to give her a run for her money and also to be able to raise the money and or marshal the money in order to mount a challenge to her.
What potholes await Brown in New Hampshire?
The carpetbagger charge is one. It's hard to know given that 25% of New Hampshire residents were born in Massachusetts. whether or not he's conservative enough to fully attract the Republican base. His positions on guns, he's pro-choice, have alienated some of them. At some of his appearances, he's been picketed by Second Amendment activists. You know, and just how he has to demonstrate his knowledge of New Hampshire issues. You know, he told me the other day when I talked to him, he's like, oh, I put 300 miles on the truck. I'm crisscrossing the state. And right now he's offering a candidacy. And no one thinks this is actually exploration. Most people appear to think he's definitely running. That's predicated on running against Obamacare and running against the president, basically. His talking point so far has been that Jean Shaheen votes 99% of the time with the president and she's lost New Hampshire value. So, you know, we'll see how it goes when he actually has to answer questions. When questioned thus far, he's like, well, I'm still exploring. I'm just checking in with people. So we don't really know, but he brings a great deal of energy to the race and seems to be well suited to the kind of retail style politics that you know, candidates traditionally need to do a lot of here.
Well, you mentioned three things. You mentioned carpetbagging, you mentioned his views on the issues, and you mentioned President Obama. What's the view of President Obama in the state, a state that he carried twice?
Well, polling indicates that there is, you know, reasonable amount of dissatisfaction, but it's hard to know. You know, New Hampshire has been a real battleground over the Affordable Care Act. We have one carrier, Anthem, which has crafted a narrow network excluding 10 of the state's hospitals. So for those people on the exchange, some of them, there's been a good deal of disruption. Obamacare has been a problem politically for the Democrats. You see Jean Shaheen scrambling. You see the two members of Congress, Democrats, Carol Shea Porter and Annie Custer, scrambling on this issue. We have a divided legislature, so the expansion of Medicaid has been fractious. That actually looks like it's definitely going to happen now. A certain slug of Republicans in the Republican-controlled state Senate had signed on. But, you know, Obamacare and Medicaid expansion have been, you know, at the top of the news for some time, and Republicans are confident that they can ride dissatisfaction or skepticism with the administration's competence to, you know, toss Democrats. We'll see. Jean Shaheen's not a supple politician. She's not hugely charismatic. She has proven herself to be durable, though, and, you know, has built up a pretty solid reputation among most voters. She continues to have, you know, reasonable approval ratings given the circumstances.
You mentioned Scott Brown's views on abortion, and you mentioned his views on guns, you know, his supporting the ban on assault weapons. These are obviously popular positions in Massachusetts, but maybe not in New Hampshire. Does it hurt? I mean, you mentioned it could hurt him with conservatives. Is there a serious primary challenge that we think?
Well, former U.S. Senator Bob Smith is running, and, you know, he's a conservative. He has a checkered political past. He served two terms in the U.S. Senate from New Hampshire. He served a couple terms in Congress before that. He broke with the party in 2000, left the party. He was unseated in the 2002 primary. Republicans recruited John Isununu, then a congressman, to run against him. And after that loss, he basically moved to Florida and was a real estate agent there and had a couple Senate runs there. So most establishment Republicans are Republicans who feel that Scott Brown would help Republicans up and down the ticket, you know, are pleased that he's running. How he does with the average New Hampshire person remains to be seen.
You mentioned the carpetbagging issue, and of course, that a lot of people in New Hampshire originally came from Massachusetts. And of course, I mean, Hillary Clinton had no problems with the carpetbagging issue. Liz Cheney, when she tried to run in Wyoming, did have problems. How big of an issue do you think it is ultimately?
I think it's hard to know. I mean, certainly there's always a possibility to make a stupid mistake that demonstrates that you're really not from here. There certainly will be opportunity for Scott Brown to do that. It's not, though, that he has no experience in the state. I mean, he'll point out that he was born at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, which is actually in Maine, but he grew up in Portsmouth for a few years as a young child. His father served at Pease Air Force Base, and he's had a vacation house in Rye for 20 years. And so he spent plenty of time in New Hampshire.
A lot has been written that if nothing else, Brown was running to force the Democrats to spend money in a state they wouldn't have had to. But I get the sense that he's not running to send a message. He's running to win. Can he win?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I think that a lot of people who are familiar with New Hampshire politics say at first blush, he has a better chance to win than any of the other Republicans. Jean Shaheen's a tough candidate to beat. She's only lost once. She runs disciplined campaigns. They may not be inspirational, but it's a grinded out style. And, you know, if there's any politician in New Hampshire who can be said to, you know, have a well-oiled machine that wins elections, it's Gene Shaheen. And
the Gene Shaheen machine.
Yeah, indeed.
Josh Rogers is a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. He can be found on Twitter at Josh Rogers and HPR. Josh, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome, Ken.
It's time for This Day in Political History. The date says March 20th, and it sure sounds like it's a headline from this year. Frustrated Republicans of the House decide to take it out on the Speaker. He's betraying conservative principles, they say. He's not acting like a leader. That may sound a bit like criticism of John Boehner today, but it was even more pronounced in 1997 when Speaker Newt Gingrich was the object of conservative scorn. Gingrich's leadership style rankled a lot of people in the party. Yes, he brought Republicans to the promised land in 1994, but after that, Republicans accused him of making mistakes and making decisions without telling his colleagues. He would abandon conservative positions when it suited him. It reached a peak on March 20, 1997. 11 Republicans voted against the GOP leadership on a simple procedural matter that led to a defeat on the House floor and egg on Gingrich's face.
Members, the House will be in order.
Moments later, he marched his troops into a closed-door session and released his fury on the 11 defectors. One of the 11 was Mark Souder of Indiana. Souder was first elected to Congress in the Gingrich Revolution of 1994 to the seat formerly held by Dan Quayle and Dan Coats. Congressman Souder, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Ken.
You came to Congress the same year Gingrich became Speaker. How did Gingrich change from when he first took over to the time people started noticing signs of revolt?
If you know the history of Newt Gingrich, you know his background when he first got elected to Congress came from kind of the left. And then as he moved through the House, he became much more aggressive to the right. We had a contract with America where we made certain pledges. We felt that those pledges, since we had distributed them and signed them as a key part of our campaign, should have been upheld. And we were frustrated when he yielded, knowing that the Senate was also going to yield further, and then Clinton would negotiate. We wanted a hard line out of the House, and we felt he was negotiating too early.
What was the response from the leadership, Gingrich in particular, when you guys voted against their wishes?
Every time, the first time we did it in 95, we were hauled into a room and told that this was typical of Republican infuting. This is why we hadn't been in control of Congress for 40 years. It led to Joe Cannon's defeat. It's the only time the Speaker got rebuked by defeating a rule like that. Who did we think we were? They bullied us. They threatened us. And ultimately, we had a pragmatic compromise, and we went right back out, passed the amended rule, and the Democrats were even more demoralized. It happened a second time. By 1997, we were 3 years in, and we were all getting a little frustrated. The Speaker barely had gotten reelected in a very tough reelection inside the conference with a number of defectors, and he continued to make decisions unilaterally without consulting the will of the conference. And that led to this showdown where he just exploded at us when we defeated it on a Friday night. And it was on a procedural vote related to committee funding. It's like voting against pay. Committee funding is an internal thing that most people don't pay much attention to, but is vital to how Congress functions.
So after that vote, apparently he marched the entire Republican conference into this closed-door room, and he exploded.
Yes, it was a Friday night. I remember Duke Cunningham's daughter was getting married, and he was getting delayed, but he actually was supportive of us. That stuck in my head because people want to get out of town. They have the planes for Codells. They say that the fumes are coming out of the engines, and everybody wants to go. So it was a good time for him to hit us because every committee chairman was upset. Members who were subcommittee chairmen were upset. They wanted to go on for their recess, and he chose to haul us up in front of the conference. And I remember there was one member of Congress in particular who had been drinking too much, and every time each one of us would go up to speak, because Gingrich said we had to go up each and defend to the other members why we would have done this terrible thing. And this particular member said that he basically used some crummy language, but he called us arrogant SOBs each time we went up, and there was a lot of heat in that room. But a number of members stood up afterwards and said, this was abuse from a speaker. We've never heard of this happening before. And it started to turn the tide. And by the next morning, Gingrich had to meet with us and eat some crow.
Did having a battle with Gingrich have any effect on you at home?
Yeah, it helped a lot. Because particularly in the class of 94, the district that I won had a Democrat in it for three terms, and she had won 62% the previous two elections. It was 12 years Democrats, 12 years Republicans, four different members of Congress. So it was a dicey district, and I was viewed as very conservative. My tone was sharper than Dan Coats or Dan Quayle, and was certainly sharper than the two Democrats that had held the seat. So by Gingrich basically trying to constantly criticize me, it made me more independent rather than a robot.
Do you see any similarities between the growing distrust conservatives had for Gingrich in 97, 98, and what's going on now with the Tea Party and Speaker John Boehner?
A little. The biggest things I see that are similar are that the grassroots expect more, as they did in 94, than they've been able to deliver, and that always creates attention. John Boehner, who came in, he was one of the guys with a sack over his head and one of the revolutionaries himself, has always had a more moderate tone, even though he himself was part of the conservative faction. In fact, was nominally involved in the Gingrich coup attempt, which cost him his conference position. I worked with him closely in the Education Committee. I watched how he listened, and his style is the opposite of Gingrich. Gingrich would charge out, have an idea in the shower in the morning, and go out and running, whereas John Boehner basically tests the wind, and then tests it one more time before he acts. Either of those things can aggravate the conservative base. I think the expectations right now at the grassroots are even more high and false, given the fact the Democrats hold two-thirds, which has put John Boehner and even Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy in a very awkward position. I also think that the class of 2010 is forcing Boehner into these boxes with no exit strategy. There is not a time we defeated a rule where we didn't know what we were negotiating for, and part of the problem with John Boehner is he doesn't face a united 2010 class that's organized like we were that could then work a deal, nor is that class organized enough to come up with a deal. So while there are similarities at the grassroots and among the members, there are unique differences related to experience and strategy.
There also seem, if memory serves, when you think back to 1995, 96, you think of the class of 1994, their goal was not to defeat fellow Republicans. It seems like many members of the Tea Party are perhaps more furious at fellow Republicans than they are at Democrats.
Yes, there's a stronger streak of libertarianism. Somebody who grew up in Young Americans for Freedom and fought these ideological battles, I see this playing out like it did in the late 60s, where we had differences over marijuana, we had differences over the draft, we had differences over the war, we had differences on social issues that were just starting to emerge. And right now, the expectation level and the divisions within the party, those two things together, have really complicated that. Our class, for example, in 94, had Greg Gansky in it, had Ray LaHood in it, had Rodney Frelinghuysen in it. It had others who were conservative but not as conservative, like Phil English and many others. Our first vote was whether to balance the budget before we did tax cuts. Tax cuts passed by one, and then we went out and voted as a block. My sense is this 2010 group is more ideologically pure, but they all want to be the leader of the band, and nobody is willing to kind of go as a team with trade-offs, even within their own class. And that makes it very hard for leadership to govern. Gingrich was an idea guy. Boehner requires sub-leaders so we can get a consensus. And he can't function right now because he's not an idea guy to provide the leadership, and he can't get a consensus within his caucus.
Mark Sauter represented the 4th Congressional District in Indiana from 1995 to 2010. Congressman, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Ken.
Before we go, a farewell to one of the most celebrated and least known governors of our time. Reuben Askew died last week at age 85. He served two terms as governor of Florida in the 1970s, campaigning for raising taxes on corporations, stronger environmental laws, and tougher ethics standards. In 1972, while George Wallace was running for president and winning the Florida primary in the process, Askew was pushing for busing to end segregation in schools. Here he is in a documentary about his governorship.
And the only hope we ever have of doing better in living together is that every mother's child has a chance in life. My mother's child had that chance, and I wanted to make sure that other children had that same chance.
Gene Stearns is a Miami trial lawyer who was a key advisor for candidate and then Governor Askew. Mr. Stearns, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's sad to say this, but outside of Florida, not many people remember the name Reuben Askew.
Well, that's not surprising to me, because he was not someone who did much to blow his own horn or attempt to create a message other than that which he was doing for this state. He was obviously very well known in Florida at the time, but other than a brief flirtation with running for president, generally speaking, was not a national figure.
If you look at the South in 1970, you know, you have Lester Maddox in Georgia. You have Orville Faubus in Arkansas making a comeback. You have George Wallace back as governor of Alabama running for president. I mean, race was a key issue, and here you have Reuben Askew calling for busing to end desegregation.
Well, you know, put a face on that. I became involved with the governor early on in his campaign and worked with him on selling tax reform. It wasn't just a corporate income tax, although that's what most people wrote and talked about.
The tax fairness.
It was really reforming the sales tax, the property tax, dealing with the way governments in Florida tax and allocated revenue. It was a major reform of the whole tax system. And not only did he run on it, but ultimately passed virtually every element of it. And again, it's taken the Republicans several decades to undo most of it. But it essentially created in Florida a fair tax system that lasted for decades until they were able to undo it. But most importantly, I'm very proud of all that, but perhaps my proudest moment of dealing with Governor Askew was when the Republicans in the legislature put on the ballot a proposal to a straw vote to ask Floridians, are you for or against forced busing? And we sat down with the governor and said, you know, listen, where are we on this? And the governor said, listen, I'm not crazy about the idea of busing children past their neighborhood schools, but let's face reality. We have a problem in Florida. It is not separate but equal. It is not equal. And we simply need to go through a process of paying the price of centuries of being wrong. And so, and frankly, I'm embarrassed that the state of which I'm governor is putting an issue like that on the ballot. And so a bunch of us got together and we said, okay, Governor, we can raise money for you to go on television and oppose the referendum. And so there were some of his political advisors who said, you'll get killed, you'll lose popularity, you want to run for reelection, you're never going to win. But there were a few of us who worked with him closely who were able to convince him that, A, you need to do it, and B, if you do it, you're not going to win the argument in this state because the feelings were very high and opposition was so great. But I will guarantee you that at the end of the day, people will admire you and respect you for the strength of your feelings, the courage with which you've expressed them. And he did that. And the strangest thing happened after he did it, after he lost that vote, which everybody knew he would, his popularity in Florida just soared through the ceiling. Because people who didn't agree with him on the issue came out and say, this is one tough guy. He's a strong guy, a man of principle, a man of courage. He's a deeply religious man. He cares about this. And so I really am proud to have a governor like this guy, governor of my state. So what he did in that campaign was eliminate Florida nationally as being a state that was identified like Alabama or Mississippi with a governor standing in the schoolhouse door. And I think people in Florida, even people that didn't agree with the position he was expressing, just felt so proud that we would have a governor with such courage and character. So that to me was probably one of the most shining moments in his career.
Well, that courage obviously translated nationwide. He was named the keynoter to the 1972 Democratic Convention, and George McGovern actually is reported to have offered him the vice presidential running mate.
Yes, he did, and I talked to him about that at the time, which was a great honor. But obviously, Governor Askew was basically a fairly conservative guy, and for example, when he made his brief foray into presidential politics, he expressed views on abortion that made him unacceptable to a Democratic Party national audience. That's really what ultimately killed his campaign early on, is that he just couldn't stand up and say something that he didn't believe in. So regardless of what the vote, those of us who liked him and supported him thought, he was just a guy that wasn't going to make it up to please people. And the truth is that you can't be involved in politics very long in a national stage without having to bend your principles. And that was not something he was ever going to do.
As you say, he had this great national acclaim in 1970 when he was elected, the stand on busing in 1972, an overwhelming re-election in 1974. But he didn't run for president until 1984. Should he have run earlier? Was it too late by 1984?
Well, the answer is obviously yes, but I don't think it would have mattered. I don't think he was really electable on a national stage, because the very factors that made him such a powerful force in Florida worked against him on a national stage.
The Kennedy School at Harvard University rated him as one of the top 10 governors of the 20th century. That's pretty impressive. When you think of Reuben Askew and his years as governor and his years of serving Florida, what's his legacy?
His legacy is sadly being eroded, if you want to know the honest truth, because what he did is being undone. Tax fairness is being undone. The rules to protect the environment have been largely undone. Ethics rules have, constantly need to be improved, not watered down, and they've been constantly watered down. So you have a legacy of a guy who was quite unusual but quite singular in his approach to politics. Most people don't realize, in a practical sense, why Reuben Askew was able to be who he was and what he was, which is he ran a campaign for governor in 1970 with no money at all. No money. He had just pennies compared to the millions that were being spent by his opponents. And he won with no money. And so we can all talk about campaign finance reform and we need to provide money for this guy and that guy. Reuben Askew, in a state in 1970, proved that you could win with ideas if you were had other things going for you and the ability to explain them. What he did, the sad thing is that no one learned from it. So it didn't turn out to be a legacy, because it was a fleeting example of how you can beat the system and elect somebody who isn't owned. Because let's face reality, when you run for office and you raise millions of dollars, the people who are giving to your campaign expect something for it. And he didn't have any of that. I mean, no, he could deal with every interest group in Florida and deal with them decently and honestly and aggressively and know that he wasn't beholden to any of them. And I dare say there hasn't been any politician in Florida since who could say that.
Gene Stearns was a top advisor for Reuben Askew. The former Florida governor died last week at the age of 85. Mr. Stearns, thanks so much for sharing your memories.
And my pleasure. I'm sorry that he's gone, but we'll all miss him. And hopefully someone else will show up on the stage with his character.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Don't forget to send your comments and questions to ken@kenrudinpolitics.com. And please consider that donate button on the homepage. We couldn't exist without your help. You can also follow me on Twitter at Ken Rudin and Ken Rudin Junkie, and we're now on Google+, and on Facebook at The Political Junkie. And here's the latest. We're now listed in the iTunes directory. Please take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. After weeks of you asking us where we've been all this time, we're finally there and we want new listeners to hear us. Some good rankings will really help. The podcast is now available on Stitcher, too. We hope you listen and share. Our producer is A.D. Quigg. Kristen Sorensen is our associate producer. Douglas Bell is our web producer. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.